I'm Bonnie Miller McLemore, and today we're going to talk about the everyday ordinary practice of sanctifying the ordinary that I really like to call pondering. I'm not sure why I put paying attention on the theme, but I thought maybe that would people know right away what that was, because we also have really immediate connotations when we hear the word ponder. How I'm going to do this session is I want to start with a meditative reading, and then I have a few ideas, but my second goal is to get you all talking and thinking and learning from each other, because there's so much resource right in the room about the theme of everyday practices of trying to practice our faith in the midst of the chaos of our lives, which is my overall theme for the week. And you know, it's interesting, when you sit here, I have to tell you, you see the windows and it kind of fades out your faces. So it's no, don't shut it, because I love the light. But and I really like, no, it's fine, honestly.
Our faces are distractions.
No. And I say that because I really like to hear and think and know what you're thinking, how you're reacting, how you're, you know, processing some of what I'm talking about. So the first scripture I want to read is the one from the theme this week, which for some reason I think it's so connected to what I'm doing, but it didn't click till like last night. I thought it would be really helpful to make the connection. This is from 2 Corinthians 4, and I'm just going to read the 7th verse. I think the 6th and 7th are both included in the theme this week. But we have this treasure in clay jars, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us. I like the first part of this. We have this treasure. I think what I'm really saying, my biggest theme this week throughout is really helping us own the treasure of the practices that we already do that cultivate faith in the midst of our lives. And when I arrived on Saturday in the midst of the parade. I guess we were the first float, which was wonderful. Everybody's like, oh, we're so glad you're coming. Just the whole town came out to welcome us. And then the Mavericks went by. And actually, I have a middle son who's a Maverick for 6 weeks this summer, which was just wonderful for me to see him when I got here. And one of the Mavericks threw me a piece of candy. Did anybody get one of those?
No.
Yeah? And what was on it?
You are a treasure.
You are a treasure. And really, I think if you take anything away from the sessions, and this was really, if you came yesterday, I realized this is really the message of sanctifying the ordinary. You know, you are a treasure. And we tend to read the last part, especially, I'm not Lutheran, but I'll tell you how I think you Lutherans read the last part. I think you emphasize the last part, it doesn't come from me. It doesn't come from me. And I think that there's another stream in the tradition, including Luther, we talked about Luther yesterday, who says it does so come from you. The story I didn't tell from Luther, that's also in my book, In the Midst of Chaos, Care of Children as Spiritual Practice. It's a wonderful story when one of his close friends, Melanchthon, says to Luther, I got a cherry bough and I put it in my dining room so that when I see it, it will remind me of God. And Luther says to him, why do you need a cherry bough? You have your children and family and chaos of your life all around you. Let that speak to you of God. So really yesterday I was saying, what a friend I have in Luther. Even as a non-Lutheran. Because because I really do think he returned the sacred to the everyday. He really did. He really challenged the church that was at that time about where the religious life was. And so for me to stumble across his really profound and irreverent words, you know, that diapers are precious jewels. I mean, Luther really was, you know, you can't believe what the kinds of things he said. And in fact, even that he, one of his more profound works that we have is Table Talk. No, not off in some mountaintop, not in the church, but around the kitchen table, which you can imagine, it's probably a lot like Holden. Holden's worship. You know, kids running, going, coming in and out, many multiple needs having to be met, and yet much going on of great meaning and deep faith around a table with lots of people in the room, and not just men, women and children. So I think in some ways, more than I realized, this, my sessions this week really complement the theme of the summer. Now the other scriptures, for today I want to put in front of us, were ones that caught my ear when I was pregnant twice at Christmas time, almost 9 months. Two of my sons are January births. Really bad planning. But it took me several years to realize that we have Christmas, and 7 days later we have a birthday, and 7 days later we have another birthday. But they kind of get shortchanged on the presents. But I had never heard the words in Luke the way I heard those pregnant. And it would be wonderful to read all of chapter 2, but I'll just excerpt where Mary is lifted up. And I just love the words. So the shepherds made haste and found Mary and Joseph and the child lying in the manger. And when they saw this, they made known what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed at what the shepherds told them. But Mary treasured all these words and pondered them in her heart. Mary treasured all these words and pondered them in her heart. Why doesn't Luke tell us more? All right, and then you go 8 days later, they take the child to get circumcised, and two people, Simeon and a prophet Anna, proclaim and witness to who they know he is to be and to become. And what's most profound is that, or maybe not most profound, but are the words of Simeon. If you hear these through Mary's ears, Simeon blesses them and then says to his mother, Mary, this child is destined for the falling and the rising of many in Israel. Can you imagine someone telling you that? Great! Wonderful! And he doesn't stop there. And to be a sign that will be opposed, so that the inner thoughts of many will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too. A sword will pierce your own soul too. As if parenting isn't tough enough already. Then to make matters a little worse, this is all we have of Jesus' early life. You know, really, Luke is a gift in this respect. And so quickly we fast forward to his early youth or late childhood. And every year they go to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover, and when he's 12, they went up as usual, and he just disappeared. Now, how many people have lost a kid for an hour or a few hours?
A few minutes.
Yeah. I had the Chicago Food Festival with my oldest, and we turn around like, oh my God, where'd he go? You know, two or three. But yeah, what were your other feelings?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I mean, this is, they travel. They actually, what was the Home Alone? they make it quite a ways. And
it's kind of like getting back to Chelan and finding your kid stay at home.
Right, it would be that kind of arduous. How is he going to get from here to there without us? And what does he say when they say, and I think we kind of pass over these passages, but when the parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said, and I'd love to hear this really read in very different, we could do it different ways, but child, why have you treated us like shit? you know, and you're so glad to see him, but you also like, kind of like want to like, you know, strangle him. Yeah. And look, your father and I have been searching for you in great anxiety. Probably the most understated in the whole scripture. And then he said, then he actually says back to them, and I mean, can you imagine your kids saying that? Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house? And the kind of knowing and not knowing. I mean, Mary's been told, and she knows, but maybe doesn't want to know. But they don't understand what he said to them. And then he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. And here are the last two verses. His mother treasured all these things in her heart. So we hear it again. So pondering really, what does it mean in this pondering? What does it mean for Mary to ponder and treasure all these things in her heart? When you hear the word ponder, what comes to mind for you? Ponder.
Mull over in the cider sense of the word, to let it all kind of steep and let all the flavors blend together.
It's a slow process.
Maybe it's considering perspectives besides your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, receptivity comes to mind, rather than being reactive, but being receptive to what's happening. Mm-hmm.
You don't ponder things you already have figured out.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and taking the time to reflect and figure out what something is, rather than just letting it rush by.
Yeah.
Like, especially when everyone, I think, has said something about treasuring.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just a blur.
And I also think, along with the slow process, it's a deeper process. Beyond the unconscious, it goes even deeper.
When I ponder, I think about different directions and what would happen. That's just the way I think. If this happens, then this. But what if this was what was to be, and then this, maybe that's what would be. I know probably none of them are right, but my brain needs to think about all the possibilities and think about what would have to, what would I do, or how should I help them to be the best they can be? What's my role in that? To ponder, am I doing this the right way? Am I rushing too much or guiding too much?
Doing it the right way. What were some of the emotions in Mary's pondering, if you had to identify? Both times. The shepherds announced depart, what was she feeling then? And the second time, what were some of the emotions that are embedded in this word ponder?
I see the two being very linked. As I think that Mary, as a mother, we, or as parents, we probably think on some level that we're bringing a person into the world that is eventually going to go off. But she's been told kind of from the get-go, that she's not only going to have to let go, she's going to have to let go on this huge scale. And Jesus kind of going off on his own at the age of 12 is one more reminder. And I'm thinking about Mary at the cross and that she's like starting that process from the very beginning. And that's awesome in terms of being able to raise a child and care for a child with that tension of having a sense that something huge is going to happen.
Exactly. So the word I use for what you described is anguish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anguish is in that word ponder. That's one of many. I think that we can find many things in that word. And I think what you also point us towards is that is parenting or any deep relationship. It's anguish from the minute it's love. And it's exactly this sense of a birth is a death. It is someone's vulnerable bringing into life that will end in death. And I think the maternal recognition of that is acute. Maybe we don't talk about it and think about it in terms of that experience of pregnancy, but I think men share it too. You know the vulnerability of a child more acutely than you ever even recognized your own, I think. The first scratch your child gets, you remember? I mean, I remember that. The tooth getting lost is something of the same kind of thing. Again, they're just finer compared to what Mary's modeling for us.
I always read these two with Hannah's story because the Magnificat and Hannah's song are pretty much the same. So I always think of these two stories together. And Hannah has to give her child up.
She gets it, it's gone.
What she prayed for the most and what she wanted the most, she has to give up. And so Mary's having to do this too. And that's the model of parenting that gets to me, is that I have to give my kid up to his own future or her own future, instead of, like your parents always think they know you better than you know yourself, and that day that you have to say to your parents, or that your kid says to you, Mom, I'm sorry, but you don't get me.
Thank you.
This is I always hope to get people. As a preview, in my last session on Friday, and I'm so glad it's after the bus departs, because it's a piece of that, that we all are going to leave here. And my last session is on blessing and letting go, and I come back to this passage because I think what's in pondering is this anguish.
I think parenting is the only job where your job is to work yourself out of a job.
Yeah, and the tension of that, and the repetitive letting go. I mean, one of the things I'll say again Friday is that we know a lot, or maybe we don't even know enough, about extreme grief. And we still are learning. But what we tend not to know enough or think enough about is just mundane, everyday grief of our daily life.
And Mary is archetypal, but also incredibly real and personal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very interesting, the way those two meet together.
And let me go, I want to make sure I come back to what else is in pondering, but that's a good segue to say, when I started looking at these passages and started looking at Mary as a Protestant, heavens forbid, Mary is And, you know, she's not only ignored, that also struck me when I was pregnant, is how absent women were. There were a lot of men up there on the, or boys up, you know, in the pageant, but Mary was pretty alone and then pretty repressed after that, you know, sort of disappears from our iconology, from our symbolism, from our tradition. And so I dug around a bit, and Luther really didn't reject Mary in the way that the Protestant tradition has carried forward some of the early Protestant movement. I think actually we can blame Calvin.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Yeah, because, you know, really Calvin was the one of really stripping the church of its paintings and so forth. And but what I discovered is that, and the, let me also get grouch about the Catholics a bit, you know. If you talk to Catholics, and there may be some who have background in Catholicism, and Mary's really ambiguous figure, you know. She's not someone that girls really want to identify with. Mm-hmm. Kind of a virgin who can have kids, you know, sort of asexual. I mean, it's really, she's got a bad history there. But when I dug around, I found some fascinating things. And some have called her the first theologian. And why? Because here, she's pondering. She's the first one to really grapple with the anguish. But what else is there? What else besides anguish?
Well, I've always thought that, I mean, I think she's told, you know, Gabriel tells her that she's going to bear Messiah, God's son. And the image of the Messiah is a king, someone that will rule, and yet she has Simeon and Anna telling that her heart's going to be pierced.
Yeah.
So I think she's probably trying to put, wait a minute, the Messiah is supposed to be this glorious figure, not someone who's going to die or going to suffer. So I think the pondering is how do these pieces
how
fit
they fit. And the flip side of the angst is, I mean, if you go back to the shepherds, they made known what had been told them about this child, and all who heard it were amazed. Amazed. So I think there's amazement or awe, which is a really powerful word. And one, just think of your own experiences with those that you love deeply. Haven't you all had those moments? And children particularly, they're like a intensification of it. They are sometimes just, you're just in awe. I mean, that's in the best of all circumstances, and lots of childbirths aren't, but sometimes childbirth is just awesome. But I think she's pondering the, not just the anguish, but the awe. The awe. Well, so what does all of this mean for us in everyday practices, sanctifying the ordinary? One of the challenges of practicing faith in the midst of ordinary life, if this was just a focus group and I asked you, what is the biggest challenge? What's one word that comes to mind? And I know I have one in mind, but maybe you have many. What makes practicing faith in the midst of chaos really hard?
Letting go.
Letting go.
Busyness.
Busyness.
Focus, finding focus.
Focus.
Feeling overwhelmed.
Feeling overwhelmed.
Allowing space.
Finding, making, allowing space. That was, in each of the chapters in this book, and I think of these practices, each time I tried to think, what impedes this practice? I didn't do it consistently, but several of the chapters. And for the practice of pondering, I put the catch of time, which all of you, really, each of those phrases were different aspects. Letting go is a thing in time. Time, finitude. Time is finitude. Or busyness, or
when you focus.
Focus. It's hard to stay focused when everything is just overwhelmed. Everything's coming at you. So pondering is a challenge in the midst of that. And it's interesting with children. I just, the material that I found that was out there that helped me think more, and whenever I could, I would find things that were done better and quote them. And a father, a friend of mine actually, has a book, Tom. He also has a complicated hyphenated name. Why do people do that? Tom Montgomery Faye. And actually, I really took footnotes out of this, tried academically to restrain myself from telling where I got everything. But that is in the back, and he has a lovely book on faith and family and the practice of writing as an author. And here are his words. I can barely remember our life without children after 10 years of parenthood, a life where I wasn't so uplifted and so weighed down, so blessed and so utterly confused, so stunned by wonder, that another way to think of awe, and stunned by worry. The "and" repeated in each of these phrases just stands out when I read this. How to sustain what he describes as the kairos, the stopping of time that comes with wonder or awe in the daily mundane every day, especially I think it's harder the older your kids get. There's a lot less awe and a lot more anguish. I think. I mean, I don't want to be unfair ever to teenagers. I think they get a bad rap, but it is true. Yeah.
Is it because we expect that awe takes this huge amount of time?
Yes.
Or is it, and so that, like, there are these fleeting, is it that it's a shift in focus, so that appreciating the sacred when it dashes by, you know, in you know, a little girl who's all dressed up as something or other, is what the sacred has become, at least for that phase of time.
I think that's a really helpful way to think of it. We think we, like, again, it has to be this mountaintop experience that, instead of something, it's quick, it's gone, and there it was, and you saw it.
And that pondering becomes the collection, in like with those treasures in the treasure box, so that when you open it up, all of a sudden there's this mosaic.
Right.
Of accumulation.
Mm-hmm. And when I was working on this chapter, some of you might know Herbert Anderson. He is a Lutheran pastor and teacher in pastoral care, and a wonderful friend and colleague of mine. And I was working on this about the same time that he was doing a lecture that included an urge for us to rethink awe and talk about ordinary awe in the midst of the mundane. And he talks about, I thought this was brilliant, he thought that we have truncated and reduced the word wow, that we've made wow, we use it all the time when we don't, you know, really mean it. So he was curious, and he sort of took an informal survey. What do people mean when they say wow? He was trying to kind of redeem the beauty of awe, I think, and the importance of attending all along. Not sort of waiting. When am I going to be awestruck? I mean, preparing yourself to be attending all along, or pondering in the midst of all of the chaos. This is something I really think churches and the faithful can help each other do better. And at the beginning of one of the chapters, it's actually titled Sanctifying the Ordinary, that I talked about yesterday, I talked about a moment, I'll just read you the paragraph, when it was like what you just described, a quick moment of awe, I think, that might have been lost. But one day several years ago when my kids were little, I stood next to my husband Mark in what we called the train park, because it was next to the commuter and freight trains rumbling in and out of Chicago. My boys were thrilled. I had three boys. I probably haven't said that, but they are now 18, 20, and 23. But when I was working on this, I've been thinking about this, my entire since the first one was so. And they were thrilled to get as close to the roar of this and the speed of the engine as we could stand, which was pretty terrifying some of the time. That day, they weren't doing anything particularly different from any other day at the park. Yet something about their sheer joy and abandon in running from slide to swing sparked a sudden and anticipated rush of matching joy. And I looked at my husband, and he knew it too. We lifted it up, and the moment passed. We need to honor and savor these moments, I write. They befriend and uphold us through less savory times. But apart from a few, I haven't heard many acclamations. And I go on to talk about diapers and laundry and playgrounds as places where this can happen. I haven't heard any acclamations or praise of this in sermons or Christian theology. I remember the train park incident. This is going to, not because, I think I remember it in part, and this isn't in the book, because I shared it. Because I had someone who could, we could say, there it was. Did you see that? I don't know what it was, but it's. But I also think because I earmarked the moment when inspired by, no, I didn't remember it because I was inspired by a church worshiper reading theology later that week. I remember it, and this, I guess it is in here. I remember it because I lifted it up first with Mark, and later, get this, in supervision and therapy during my pastoral counseling training. So psychology, for all the ridicule that it gets as being navel-gazing, I think is really its gift to culture, despite its problems and its criticisms, which are sometimes valid. It has given us tools to do valuable searching of the most concrete time. And this is where I think if most sermons, liturgies, and theologies, they could start to make more space to mark the sacred in the daily and celebrate the intricacies of parenthood as a faithful vocation where these moments happen for many of us, so that we can learn to stop and notice. In other words, I say my clinical training fostered good parenting and deepened my faith. Maybe it's time for the church to, you know, help us do that a bit more.
Yeah, I think about, I'm missing on psychologist, and there's a family therapy model where the therapist is in another room and the parents are playing with kids and there's like a little microphone and the therapist might kind of give gentle coaching to the parent. And I think, as a parent, I want that microphone in there. In some of those times when it's like, it's a tussle, or my emotions are up. And I think for me, peers, friends, that your spouse being able to look at you and extra moment, and also my faith, and talking to God can be those moments of my secret microphone, because I need it. There are times when emotions and things are going so fast, you want time to stop and just, let's freeze frame this so I can think about which way I want to take this. And it's happening so fast. And I just think that, I think our faith can provide some of that, you know, secret microphone help that we need in those moments to make it more awe-inspiring and not just a stressful transition.
That's a wonderful image. So you're saying you're saying things to the parent that can be of help. Oh, wow, that's a fine, fascinating image.
Whatever the parent has said that they could use help with. I mean, they may need help in interpreting the child and their needs. They may need help in reminding things they've practiced with the therapist on count to three, whatever they need. I mean, the parents involved in it, kind of in planning.
Yeah.
But then in the play interactions, and the kid doesn't know it per se. I mean, that's the assumption. But
yeah. So pondering when you describe that, it's like a second chance, a second voice, a second view, another angle.
Because for me, the piece is to not be alone in it. Like there's some moments in parenting where I'm still alone, you know?
Right.
And so faith can really help me, my relationship with God can really help me to love that.
Well, and that's just another, yesterday when people introduced themselves, one of the things that helped me here is that there seemed to be kind of two different needs of coming to this. One was parenting, needing to hear other parents. I'm not the only one feeling this or encountering this struggle to be feeling as if I'm still praying in the midst of all this, that I'm still have a spiritual life, that this is my spiritual life, that this actually, and it ought to be honored and treasured. So parents hearing other parents. But I also heard the need for ministers to rethink, how do we do family ministry? And one of the things that not being alone is providing forums where parents hear other parents. Or what I really see here modeled, Holden, is generations of, you know, so I can say to, I've got an 18-year-old, if you want to talk to me about what it was like to have a 15-year-old, I think I would have appreciated that when I had or even broader generational differences you have in the church, and to create forums and places of, you know, making connections so people aren't feel also alone in their ways of viewing their situation. Yeah.
Two things striking. One is that the parables of Jesus, so many of them are household parables. The lost coin, the leaven and the lump. I think in some ways we have so made those such archetypes that we've forgotten he's really talking about everyday stuff that everybody knows. And when you said, you know, do we ever hear this in sermons? It's, you know, Jesus did it all the time, and I think we've sort of made these very almost abstractions rather than the very concrete things. And the one it made me think of the event in our church. It was 8 years ago, 9 years ago. Someone just was insisting we do a blessing of the animal service. All right, we'll do a blessing of the animal service. And we decided to do it in the sanctuary, even though there could be accidents and all of that, because that's where real worship happens. And so we had all these dogs, you know, sitting over the pews. And I blessed dogs, cats, guinea pigs, chinchillas, a parrot. And people love their pets. And it's a huge part of people's lives, and the church never touches it, and it's sacramentalized as part of their life. And so you've got me thinking now, how do we help, again, sacramentalize play in the park, or doing the dishes, or those moments, we can think of a bunch of times where either words of wisdom or great hilarity came from the back seat when they were strapped into a car seat. Especially like when they're imitating you, yeah. Getting mad at the we talk about such lofty things, and I think we in church sometimes and in sermons, and it's so structured and formal, and there's good reason for that. I'm not arguing against that, but I think we crowd out that every day, and people, the mad rush out the house. I can tell you what families are always going to be 10 minutes late, and they almost always have kids. And people feel bad about that, and instead, you know, what if that chaos was celebrated, or just, not even such, just, that's life.
Yeah. Yeah.
You made it. It's like people cheering at the bus here. What a cool thing.
Yeah.
That word stuff, I'm struck by that, because another person I know who teaches actually in Britain and has been doing and thinking about pastoral care for a long time just sent me something he wrote that was about stuff. And he talked about how pastoral care and ministry had been taught, and he had been teaching it, to mostly just ignore the stuff. You know, don't, like when you go to talk to someone, the clutter of the home is just not important. And he began to realize, oh my goodness, those are things that, you know, define us, and that become special. And, you know, he talked about his special pen, that, you know, And I think that we have, I think the Protestant tradition, if you think about this struggle and tug we have about sanctifying the ordinary, there is a pushback, certainly, in the Protestant tradition. And it goes back to the Jewish tradition, too. And it's, you know, it's a little less emphasized in the Catholic, and that is we don't want to idolize our stuff. Because, you know, God really isn't in the stuff completely. God is so much more. But the Protestants have really, like, gone to the extreme on that. And it's an interesting, you know, this is probably not as much of an issue in a Catholic way of viewing the world, where there is a sense of the sanctity of the ordinary a bit more embedded in that tradition than in some of the Jewish and some of the Protestant tradition. Diane, you look here, and then back to...
I just was thinking about what this does to not making all of life about accomplishment, which we tend to do. And my kids are older, and we went through a phase, which we are gratefully in today, where my older son had some very serious problems psychologically. And accomplishing for him was going to be getting through the next day alive, not, you know, what is he doing when he graduates from college, you know? And it really makes you pull back from all of that pushing about making sure you get into a good college and all that stuff. Like, can we just, you know, make sure you're alive? And somehow now back to that pondering in your heart, what it's gonna, you gotta like switch how you're related to your kids. If it's about celebrating where they are when it's just awful, I mean, awful. But also giving up that what makes life meaningful is what you accomplish.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe concentrating on the ordinary helps us do that. So you don't get in those competitive conversations with other parents. Well, my daughter is, you know, all swell. I mean, which I'm capable of doing, mind you.
And I like the phrase that you just used, switch how you relate to your kids. I think it's, again, it's not, it is very related to this pondering. It is a shift of how you see. It is a turning of, and a changing, a conversion experience in a way, letting your child convert you. And in fact, one of the emphases through this book is, okay, you think you form your children, but guess what? They are forming you.
They also pull you out of your own work.
That's right.
I had lots of people say to me, how can you do what you do and have kids? And I said, how could I do what I do and not have kids that pulled me away from taking myself so darn seriously?
That's right. And to remind you, this is what life is about. This is more important. I mean, I actually, as my last one leaves home, that is a number one worry. How am I going to sustain my perspective on life without their immediate... And I've felt this for the last 5 to 6 years. Gotta have those grandkids. Come on, kids. But, you know, I felt that even as my kids, and I know some of you have kids at this age and are going to think, oh, I'm never going to want that. But I miss the body. They were always on me, on top of me. And you know, I'm like, I'm sweating when you get, but now I, you know, for the last 5 to 10 years, send your kids over. You know, but because that was a reminder, it was a bodily reminder of what was more important in my life. And kids do that. And I also think that they do what, that other story, when you sit behind you in the car seat, imitating about, they reflect back your foibles. Mm. You know, you're getting mad, and so the kid is like, go faster, Dad. We had one that always was telling me, you know, when I'm driving, go faster, Mom. And I'm like, where is that coming from? You know, but I think I was conveying, we got to get there, we got to get there. You know, and so they form us. Whether it's reflecting our foibles or saying, you know, you think it's all about the best college, but it's there's something more about life than what you think. And I think they even inform us in this attention. One of the authors I stumbled across that I quoted yesterday was Janet Soskas, and she talked about how children form us in this hovering. Those of you who have younger children, that when you have a young child, you have to watch things. So like, are they going to fall off this? Are they going to get on? You know, you're just, there's like, you develop this additional way of seeing the world. And I like to think of that as a spiritual, they hone you in the spiritual practice of attention. Mm-hmm. You know, why not claim that? That is really, and also the other way that it's described by a philosopher, Simone Weil, is that constant question of, let me get it in her words exactly, what are you going through? You know, being a parent means always asking yourself, what are you going through? What, I mean, and I'm saying that's probably more acute when you have an infant. You got to figure out, are they hungry? Are they diaper? Or are they just being pissy? And, you know, I mean, but what are you going through is a refrain that's also children hone in us by the sheer need to respond to them. That is actually a profound attitude towards life.
It's interesting in talking about the relationship of family within the church, and I'm going to say community. It seems like community is this wonderful opportunity, and I think that cultures where there is simply less stuff, this is more perhaps closer to the surface, where wisdom, the wisdom of the generations, or the sacred of the interactions amongst people become more the focus. And one of the really special things about being up here, and that maybe it gets lost a little bit when we go back into our everyday life, is having this opportunity to have the wisdom of generations and the perspective that those who have newborns get from those who have four-year-olds, or those who have children that are grown and have a sense of what one thinks, like, I'm all alone going through this and I have to make it up because I've never done this before. To have that available to us from people that are not blood related to us, because I'm still my mother's daughter, and I still carry the tapes and the muscle memory of our interactions when I was my daughter's age. But to have that wisdom available is really a gift, and one that I think that we have within our church community by lifting up the family and the potentially sacred in our ordinary struggles. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense, yes, but community, yes, kind of comes up in all of this.
You remind me of something I was going to say earlier, which is some Sundays, going to church, I don't think that I get a whole lot out of the sermon or anything, but sometimes it's just sitting there with my children and looking at, you know, I've belonged to the same church for 30 some years, and looking at the kids who I knew when they were two and they're teenagers, and just like looking at the backs of everybody and thinking, okay, they survived this, and they survived the chaos, and they've gotten there, or those teenagers went to college and they're back home now, and just sometimes the sort of my time to ponder is just going, I will get through this, and I'm sure there are challenges there, and there are challenges there, and, you know, but just, they're surviving it, and I will survive it, too, and sometimes that's what I take away on Sundays, and that's enough for me.
Yeah, and it's an alternative conversation to that competitive conversation. It's the vulnerability in having, I don't know if my son's going to make it through the next day, and having somebody else say, yeah, you know, I went through that. And there's a real potential gift in that. But it's a very vulnerable way of being community.
Yeah, I mean, what I hear that you're partly saying is you sort of get a blessing. You go and you get a blessing on, I'm doing all right, like this, yeah.
The kids are alive,
the kids are alive. Yeah, and that is visibly seen, and just seeing the growth and movement of the generations through the church, which again I think is such a powerful thing that churches do. And one of the things our church really does right is at the final senior year, just has such a celebratory service and dinner, just recognizing, I mean, again, just one moment. I think that the church does that with many moments, baptism, confirmation, maybe not with enough recognition that this is the anguish that which we reach each of these moments. We made it here. We made it to this.
I've mentioned this to you, and so I had a bookstore yesterday. I think at least in traditions where we have infant baptism, there's really some opportunities to rethink baptism. Parents almost become incidental. I mean, they make the vows and promise, but I don't know, in the Lutheran tradition, the Presbyterian tradition, we don't have a specific blessing for the parents. We ask the congregation, they're asked the vow to love and support and nurture this child. In the Presbyterian tradition, we typically don't have godparents because the congregation are the godparents for the child. You can have godparents if you want. But the parents kind of almost props to hold the baby until the minister, till the important hands get on this baby. And not to deny any or to subvert any part of the baptismal theology of Presbyterians or Lutherans or any other tradition, but I think we're missing a tradition there. As you're talking about this community you walk into, there's this 91-year-old woman who's about 4'5" now. She's probably lost a couple inches since I've been there. And one of her great prides is that children measure themselves against her. Oh. You're taller than Ginny, you're really growing up, and she just loves that. What if she, you know, someone of one of the elders of the church, the older elders of the church, stood there also as a representative, as a witness for the baptism, to bless the parents as well and to pass on their wisdom and to bind that community. It's got me thinking that...
I think you're on the exact right track. And actually, my thinking about this is less in this book and probably more in other things I've written, but I do think that there is, you know, a general movement in religious education, there's literature there, to say that every life cycle ritual should be a moment where everyone is involved at different levels. And then to reduce that, at least the family, the parent. So a confirmation or a baptism or a wedding is not just about the individual. That I heard somebody else recently describe a wedding and how when you go, if you're not married yet and you're thinking about it, you're thinking toward it as you watch someone else's marriage. Or if you're married, it's a reaffirmation of your own. In other words, the ritual has a ripple effect, and to rethink how we think about rituals away from this individual. I think it's really true for us. I'm from a American-born religion, Christian movement, Disciples of Christ. Some of you know at Christian Church, we baptize, quote-unquote, adults. But it's like confirmation, and the more the families are involved in the educational process up to baptism, the better. Or other non-biological adults. So, for example, I've served as a mentor in that process. And I think, in fact, my congregation doesn't do enough with that mentorship. I was thinking that wouldn't it be wonderful if I didn't just show up at baptism, but that when this person keeps moving through high school and college, I remain a primary person for her. So I think we've truncated some of our most important life cycle rituals. Yeah.
I'm also have been learning from colleagues that we too often think about rituals only in the congregation instead of the family. And how can we help parents say, all right, what ritual am I going to go through with my children at bedtime? And so I've learned from Marcia Bunny, for example, about saying, what was I grateful for today? What, you know, what was troubling today? You know, go through the lament and blessing with your children. And then another person said, and every week we, and maybe Chris Sharon, who said, we decide where we're going to give money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what cause we're going to, you know, so we have, you know, our $10 this week. What's going on in the world that we want to help? And just do all these rituals with your children, which I never did and I really regret.
But you did do that. What I think I was talking about yesterday is that in some ways my book is saying, there were things that you did. What were they? If they weren't those, they might be others. And I forget what I'm doing tomorrow. Doing justice. How did I do that in the mundane? I didn't know I was doing it, but I think I was doing it around the dinner table. I'm going to talk about that practice. I think you just named a couple others, though, the bedtime practices. And you probably had something that you were or that you were doing that was conveying your faith, I think. But I think you're right. The second thing I would want to say is, you're saying, I wish I'd cultivated those a bit more. I wish I'd had help. I wish someone had told me, take what I'm doing and do it deeper, richer, think more about it. I'm going to talk about reading, too, as another thing I think I was doing, but I didn't realize I was doing it as a spiritually formative practice, reading to my children, and what that looks like. But it's interesting, the ritual that you just described, it has a rich history, and we of the bedtime. That, what I hear echoes is from, it's not like I've studied this a lot, but Ignatius has an exercise of what he calls consolation and desolation. Those two questions of what am I, lamenting from the Bible study this morning, but then what am I also rejoicing? And what's interesting about this, the St. Ignatius exercise of that, it's called the examine, is that you can do it any time, but bedtime is a great time, and with children maybe building that practice, that's a wonderful, I wish I had done that too. So, so hearing these things, that really is good. We're ready to close. This was wonderful. I always have other stuff I want to say, but to be continued. So thank you all for coming. It's fun.